Hello again, everyone. It's time again for Chatter on Books. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, guys, welcome back to Chatter on Books. This is our annual Turkey Palooza. It's kind of about books. It's kind of not about books. Chatter on Books. Lots of things on tap. I came up with a pop quiz this afternoon, which makes me so happy because I love pop quizzes. Talk about presidential memoirs. We'll talk about an absolute icon who's in the book world and also something that's very, very important. But most importantly, for those of you who are tuning into the show because you thought Jeannie McManus was going to be with us, she's not. You can just stop listening now. Jeannie had to be a late scratch. We're very sorry. She's promised me she will come back with us in 2021, but she can't be with us. But we have Claude Jennings doing all the important work. We've got David Aldrich here, of course. I won't rag on him.
Thank you.
At least for one day, about the sports world not covering the Steelers the way they ought to be covered.
Yeah, nobody, they get no ink.
Nobody.
That's true.
Nobody. I mean, no, stupid Joe Burrow injury gets more coverage than the Steelers.
No, it's a stupid Joe Burrow injury.
I do. Okay, most importantly, our Chatter on Books alum, Nevin Martell. Nevin, I never know how to describe you. You're
That's
an author.
Question.
You're a photographer. You write cookbooks. You write about Calvin and Hobbes. You write about Dave Matthews. You tell people where to eat and what to eat. You're like this incredible 21st century Renaissance man. How do you describe yourself? And welcome back, by the way.
It's so good to see you both. Like, it's nice to be in the home office, but feel connected to you guys through the interwebs. You know, it's, to be honest, I've always had a hard time categorizing myself. And over the years, my title on my business card or on my website have changed so many times, you know. For a while, I was, you know, pop culture archaeologist to cover like all the music writing I was doing and bridging into the world of, you know, Calvin and Hobbes and cartooning. But then, you know, I did a lot of food writing, cookbook writing. And so that takes precedence. And then there's, you know, parent writing, you know, parenthood writing that I've done. And, you know, to be honest, I just kind of keep it to writer photographer a lot of the time, just because that's the most succinct way of saying it. And then if you want to have more of a conversation about it, you know, buy me a drink or buy me a coffee and I'd be glad to send you down the rabbit hole.
Maybe it should just be writer slash photographer slash
bon vivant.
Bon vivant. Exactly. Bon vivant. What's raconteur? What's a raconteur?
That's a storyteller. And you know, that, to be honest, is a word that my dad used to like to use to describe himself, because he would love to tell, he was like in more in the oral tradition of storytelling. And I think it's a great word. I think it's also a little bit freighted. And I think that since Jack White took the name for the band, I feel like, you know, he gets it. You know, I feel like with some of those words, like, it seems like you're trying too hard to, you know, big up yourself.
To sound fancy.
Yeah. And I'm humbler than that. You know, I don't. So I just like living my life.
Pretty much any word that has E-U in it, because rock and roll ends at E-U, right? E-U-R.
Yes.
That's like somebody's trying too hard.
It does sound a little bit like you're trying too hard.
Yeah. So how's the pandemic been treating you?
Well, you know, from a writing perspective, like the freelance work has definitely taken a hit. But from the cooking, baking, bread making, gardening, foraging perspective, it's been off the charts good, because now there's all this time to do it and two other mouths to feed and be eager, kind of, you know, kind of like experimental mice for whatever I bring home and whatever I decide to cook. And no, it's, you know, it's like we were saying before we started rolling tape, that, you know, it really makes you think about what's important and who's important. And so there's certainly been a lot of time to kind of focus on the things that mean a lot to me, which are family and food, and also to spend more time perfecting the art, say, of making sourdough or, you know, hunting for morel mushrooms or whatever the case might be. Things that I just had a time to write about or before, but not really do. That was kind of the irony of my work, is I had a lot of time to write about food, but I didn't really have a lot of time to cook it or bake it or go looking for it. So
I totally get that.
It's been a mixed bag, but I'm not complaining at all. It's been, it's been the most interesting year of my life.
Wow. My daughter today announced that before the year ends, our core family that we've spent a lot of time with over the last 9 months has to make sourdough bread, because we're the last people left in America who have not made sourdough bread.
Why? Why sourdough bread?
David, have you made sourdough bread in your family?
No. And no one's expressed
feel bad about that
any desire to do so. I'm just curious, like, what got her on sourdough bread?
That's a pandemic staple. Everyone's made sourdough bread, except for you.
Is that true?
It has been a bit of a thing.
That's a thing?
And the thing that I'll say about it is that for the first couple months, I didn't have control over anything in my life, in the sense that none of us did. Like, everything was being taken away from us and we had no say in it.
Right.
And so many things were changing and we had no say in it. When I started making sourdough, my first loaves were total failures. Like, I killed the first starter I had. You know, the loaves that I made were just awful. They wouldn't rise properly. But when I mastered first my starter and then the bread itself, it was literally the only thing in my life that I felt like I had control over.
Yeah.
And it was so rewarding because I finally felt like, if for just a few minutes when I was working on it, I knew what to do and I could manipulate it the way I wanted it to.
Wow.
And I was happy with the results. And I couldn't say that about anything else.
So control was it. Control.
And to be honest, eating bread fresh out of the oven,
yeah,
like, you can't beat that, you know?
Yeah.
And my family loved it. And making my family happy at a time when there were so many things to be unhappy about was also really, really rewarding.
Yeah.
I recommend it. And if you don't do it, Tori, tell me and I will drop off a fresh loaf for you.
I was somewhere recently.
You too, David.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I can't remember where I was, but somewhere in the DMV, it was a bakery where mm-hmm. you could go in at a certain time in the morning and they would have made the dough.
Ah.
And ooh. They would only give you the dough in a certain time frame, say 10 a.m. to 12 noon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you race it home and yeah. you put it in the oven. So then you get the smells and.
That's so
wow. Good. Kind of like a bread baking meal kit almost. Yeah. Like, you've done all the hard work. You just need to cook it.
Yeah. Or okay. if you spend most of your life in the DMV, you don't do anything. You hire people who do things for you.
That's right.
Create this wonderful experience. Okay, so Nevin, several months ago, I think it must have been in May, you mm-hmm. wrote a wonderful piece for Mother's Day. And you said, everything I learned about being a dad, I learned from my mom.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it was wonderful. And I have a similar experience, but you first.
Yeah, my mom was the parent of my two parents that really took control of my childhood and my upbringing. My dad was the guy that planned crazy trips and would take me to the toy shop to buy stupid stuff that I didn't really need. And my mom was the one that really taught me ultimately how to be a parent. She was, you know, the rule setter and, you know, usually the person who delivered punishments.
But
she did it always in a way that she would explain the boundaries. She would tell me when I had gone over the boundaries and then she would remind me of the punishment for that. and then mete out said punishment. And, but no, I mean, she in so many different ways, not just kind of like making sure that I was a well-behaved kid, but like taught me how to be in the world. And in a way that when I became a parent, I realized that she was kind of teaching me all along the best way to be with a kid and to raise a kid without hitting me over the head. And, you know, she's not a person that has like sayings like, you know, or would like sit me down and have long philosophical conversations. She's really somebody that teaches through example. And it took me a long time to realize that, because when I first had my son, I just kind of turned to my dad and was like, so how do I do this? Mm-hmm. And he was like, I don't know, ask your mom. Basically, that's what
totally
I did
had that experience.
When we were married.
Yeah.
And I kind of laughed about it and was bitter about it for a little while. And then I kind of realized that even though that's not what he meant, like, you know, I should probably look to my mom as an example. And when I did look back, I was like, oh, she's given me a great roadmap and she's still here to kind of help me along it.
Yeah. So. David, where'd you learn your parenting skills?
Yeah.
The bottom of this glass? No.
Your parenting skills are all canon.
As David thinks about where he learned his parenting skills years ago, and it was when my kids were little, there was a great study, and I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, and it said that women who were breastfeeding their babies, who drank a glass of red wine every night, said that their babies slept better at night. And my friends and I, who were all pregnant, having babies, were like, are you kidding me? Of course they slept better at night, because we didn't hear them because we're drinking a cup of glasses of wine.
Exactly. We passed out. Outstanding.
David,
cried themselves to sleep. Yeah. Parenting skills. I don't know. I don't know where one learns how to be a parent, because, well, I'll speak for myself. I was so incredibly bad at it when I started. I mean, you know.
We all were.
Yeah.
Everybody is.
Yeah. So you're just like, I just don't want to break this child. That's what I don't want to do. Because I don't know where to get the child fixed. Where do you go to get a, you know, the warranty is expired. And I don't know. You know, you learn, you think about the things that your mother and your father said over and over and over again, and you realize that they were saying it for a reason, and that you should utilize some of it now. But this crying, mewling, spitting being, she beast that's in your home now. So no, it's what you just take a little bit from them. And you know, I married a really smart woman who's really much better at this than
best
I am.
Best move you've ever made. Dave.
Absolutely.
Best move. Yeah.
No, she's clearly the star of the parenting family. I'm just here. I'm the guardrails. I look at that as I'm the guardrails, just to make sure that they don't face financial or some other type of, you know, ruin.
Do no harm. Do no harm.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, and then she can maneuver them. And I try to help when I can. I'm sure I do more than that, but.
I'm sure you do.
I'm sure you both feel the same way. You're you, right? You know who you are, and you've been that way your whole life.
And you can't change it that much.
Yeah. No, and you don't change it that much. And so so the idea that you're suddenly going to become a parent is just, it's almost laughable to me that someone wouldn't trust me with their child, and it happens to be me.
Somebody about 6 months ago, new parents, brand new baby, and long story short, they were asking my advice on stuff. And I said, stop. No, that is like malpractice. And they said, come on, you've got three children and this and that.
Yeah, come on.
And they're not in prison. And I said,
that's the bar these days?
Right.
That's the bar?
And I said, I've had three goldfish. That does not make me effing Jacques Cousteau, okay? So no, I refuse to offer any advice whatsoever. But I do remember once when our kids were little and like really little, and they're just, you know, screaming and yelling. My mother's still alive. And I called her and I was like, oh, losing my mind. And I'm just talking it out. And I said to her, you know, they just get a little bit older and a little bit more self-sufficient. This is going to be great.
Easy. Yeah.
And there's a very pregnant pause. And she raised five girls, by the way, Nevin. And then this almost hysterical laughter. And she said, you think it gets easier? She laughed hysterically. But then, God rest her soul, she passed away many years ago. And I remember calling my dad often and saying, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do? And he would say, oh, you need to talk to your mother. I said, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
But he was same thing. And I was so struck by your piece back in May because I thought, yeah, I mean, my dad really, really appreciated everything she had done. Yeah, and he was so in awe of what she had done.
It's a totally different skill set that I think mothers have. They can, I mean, it's, you know, it's psychic. It's all, you know, there's just a connection there that fathers simply, well, I shouldn't say that like that. I think I struggle with my kids to reach them, you know, my wife can reach them. Who knows why? She just can. So
if there's some Darwinian genetic.
Yeah, it's fine. It doesn't bother me. It is what it is, you know?
Yeah. All right. All right. Should we pretend to talk about books a little bit?
Absolutely. You can pretend to talk about anything, Tor.
Yeah.
Okay. Have either of you bought and or read Barack Obama's memoir?
No, not yet. It's on the Christmas list.
David?
Yeah, no, not because I don't want to. I would love to read it. I read Dreams of My Father. I'm trying to remember if I read the second one or not. I think I might have read part of the second one. Mm-hmm. It's not that I have any particular grand desire to read about Barack Obama's presidency. I mean, you know, I think you know, I think you'd agree. Most presidential biographies are stilted and stultifying and very few of them give you the real stuff. So I'll read it because I think I should, but I don't have any great, like, I'm not going to be first in line at whatever Borders or whatever whatever's out there now. I don't know. Bookstores.
Exactly. I think Hannah Depp Oliver told us last week from Loyalty Books, Nevin, that there's a shortage of paper, and Barack Obama's memoir for which they had, you know, wanted to preprint millions of copies, had to be printed in Germany. Is that what you said, David?
Yes. Yeah. Shipped over. Yeah. That's
so, Nevin, will you read it? You will read it.
Yeah, probably in the new year. It's I have a couple of things that I need to finish up, but I did read his first book, and I'm interested to hear what he has to say about his presidency. Though I agree with David, most of those books tend to be, you know, obviously very one-sided and not the kind of true look. I would rather get the tea from an outsider than from the president himself.
And as David's heard me say several times, one of my all-time favorite books ever, not just in the political world, but ever, mm-hmm. is Michelle Obama's book.
Yeah.
Because it has next to nothing to do about politics. It's about this, yeah. I mean, what we were talking about earlier, this 21st century couple.
Yeah.
And how they manage their life and their relationship and their family and their careers. And it was so unstilted. It
was so very honest. Open, very so honest.
Transparent. And I've not read it yet. I've not read Barack Obama's yet. I've ordered it from my favorite local independent bookstore. But you just read the reviews and you read the coverage of it thus far. And it's all written very, as they all are, to David's point, they've written very defensively.
Yeah.
I need to address that complaint. I need to confront that allegation. I need, those kinds
spin,
of things.
Spin.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it's almost work to go through them. Okay, but here's the pop quiz.
Okay.
Uh-oh. Oh, geez.
Why do you like pop quizzes, by the way?
I didn't know that I was going to have to prepare, Tori.
And pop quizzes.
I love pop quizzes. Well, if I told you about it, it wouldn't be a pop quiz, please.
Darn it. Man, like 10th grade physics all over.
Oh, wait, the GSA has officially recognized that the guy who won by 6 million votes actually won the election. That's good. That's good.
Yay, there you go.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, they just
for
did.
Real.
So, yeah. Well, that's something. Well,
she didn't want to have to go before Congress tomorrow. So she was like, I'll just give it to him. Fine.
All right, you won by 6 million votes. All right.
Oh, my God. Thank goodness.
At some point, we're going to have a special Chatter on Books. Never, as you know, this is a largely apolitical world, Chatter on Books. But at some point, we're going to have a special show, which is we get to say everything we want to say.
You'll definitely get lit up for that one.
That will be the last Chatter on Books.
That will be the last Chatter on Books. It will involve golf courses. I'm just telling you.
All right, get on with your pop quiz.
All right, presidential memoirs. Which president took the longest to write his memoir? And just for the purposes of this, we're going to start with Jimmy Carter to the president.
I was going
to
say George Washington. No, that doesn't get.
God.
The longest to write his memoirs.
I mean,
I'm going to say.
Leaves office. How long did it take before his memoir?
41. 41.
I'm going to say the first Bush.
Yeah, 41.
Yep.
Barack Obama.
Really?
Yeah. 3.8 years.
Yeah.
3.8.
Bush's memoirs came out sooner than that. I remember that.
Yeah, 41 doesn't even make the list. Okay, who took the shortest amount of time?
Clinton. I'm sure it's Clinton.
Reagan.
Interestingly, Jimmy Carter, Bush 43, David, and Ronald Reagan each took 1.8 years to get theirs out.
I would not have thought of Clinton.
Yeah. Reagan really.
Carter.
Right, Jimmy Carter. And Reagan, I remember this. He wasn't really. He had a ghostwriter, of course. I can't remember who it was.
Lou Cannon, right? Wasn't it Lou Cannon?
No, Lou Cannon wrote a book about him.
Oh, okay. I thought he was his ghostwriter. Okay.
Yeah. And but he wasn't interested in it. And he thought it was so silly. And when the book came out, they did an event, and he talked about how he might read it someday. But they took 1.8.
Love that.
And all my questions and answers are off the internet. So if they're wrong, it's not my fault. What's the shortest presidential memoir? And this goes all the way. Think of all your presidents. What's the shortest presidential
Millard Fillmore's.
Good guess, but wrong. Nevin?
Working title was I Sucked by shortest? Millard Fillmore.
Did somebody write a haiku? Say it again. Did somebody write a haiku for their memoir?
No, that'd be too clever.
God,
Calvin Coolidge.
Oh.
Calvin? Oh,
247 pages.
Of course. Huh. Do you know the story about Calvin Coolidge?
No.
The famous dinner. You never heard this famous dinner story?
No.
Calvin Coolidge was the president. He was having a state dinner. Someone sat next to him. I don't know if she was the queen of some country or a princess. And she said, "I understand you don't say very much." And he said, "That's right." And she said, "Well, I bet my husband I could get more than two words out of you tonight." And he looked at her and said, "You lose."
So awesome.
Wow.
Oh, that's great.
That's awesome.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who had the longest presidential memoir?
Well, it's got to be Clinton. Come on. He's still talking, isn't he?
Or was it someone like, I don't know, Eisenhower?
No, Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Was it really?
1,008 pages. Obama's the first volume, by the way.
Yeah. And
by the way, I adore Barack Obama, and I just love the chutzpah and the chestiness and the, yeah, this is my first, you know, 755 pages, right?
When did he get $75 million? What was his advance? He got
it was genius. He and Michelle Obama struck the deal together, and I think it was a 65 or 75 million dollar deal together.
Yeah, yeah, Jesus.
Which is pretty genius.
Just wait, they're gonna tack a third one on. Like,
this is unbelievable. Robert Carroll is going, okay, that's enough. Stop.
Right. Well, the kids haven't written their book yet. Obama's first volume, 768 pages. Bush 43, 497 pages. Bill Clinton, 1,008 pages. Jeez. But I like this better. 3.45 pounds.
Wow.
It weighed 3.5 pounds.
That's like a Murakami novel. Like one of the...
Yeah.
IQ84 or something. Jeez.
Exactly. But again, I just say Michelle Obama.
Oof.
One of the best books ever.
Yeah.
It could go in any category. It could just go in. It is fabulous. Okay. On the Chatter on Books Reflected Glory front, the Washington Post, our friend Ron Charles and all his cohorts, the Washington Post, recently came out with their best books of 2020 list. Yeah. And number two on the list was The Cold Millions by Jess Walter.
Oh, yeah.
Three or four weeks ago, David?
Yes. He was really interesting.
The Cold Millions, two brothers, Spokane, Washington, early 1900s. Great book. And I just want to point out that we had him on the show, and 2 weeks later, the Washington Post declares it the second greatest book in 2020.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Just saying.
Okay. Here's my icon pop quiz. Which phenomenal singer has been instrumental in research for the COVID vaccine?
Dolly Parton.
Attaboy. Yes.
Yeah.
Then she gave $1 million, right?
God bless her. You know?
She did. Early in April, she gave $1 million to Vanderbilt University that had started some of this research. And it's now known as the Dolly Parton COVID-19 Research Fund. And these people are very busy, but they've come out of the woodwork to say when she gave us that $1 million was critical to the research we've been doing.
Yeah.
I love this woman.
Dolly Parton.
Well, I think we got to try to get her on the show.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Can I come back for that show? That
Absolutely.
We have 163 people doing the show that way.
Exactly.
Dolly. Yeah.
But she
Hello,
is,
Dolly.
We trick people into being on the show sometimes. Right, right. I think Ken Fala is still going, who were those idiots? Who were we talking to that time?
He was fine. Yeah. He was counting his money. He was fine.
You know, he's rich. Commercial break about Ken Fala. That guy is a pro.
Yeah. He was good. He was fine. Yes.
I mean, he has completely adapted to the virtual world.
Yeah.
And he was a pro, and he showed up, and he was bright and attentive and funny, and like, God bless him.
10 out of 10 on Room Raider, I'm sure, if they looked at it. It was good. It was good. I was pleasantly surprised because I thought, you know, he big shot commercial author. He doesn't, you know, but he acted like he actually cared about what
That's great.
He was fat, but he acted like he really cared. I think he did. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Dolly Parton, in addition to her $1 million to the COVID research, she is a goddess in the book world. And she started this many, many years ago. It's called, what is it called? It's called Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she has given away about, so far, 150 million books. 150 million.
That many.
It's not as many as books that Ken Follett has sold. What was it, David? 170 million?
170, something. Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, some insane number.
Horrifyingly large number.
Yeah. Doesn't include the movies, the TV shows.
Right, no, of course.
Right? No. The dolls. but she's given away about 150 million books to children worldwide. And it's the greatest story. Her father could not read. And as her career was taking off and she's incredibly successful and making tons of money, she's given away a lot of money. She wanted to do something to honor her father. So she started this literacy project. Mm. And before he died, he said to her, that's the most important thing you've done. Oh. Not her career, not her story, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So Dolly for president.
Compliment there.
Yeah.
Well, see, people like that give you some hope, right?
So
great.
Yeah. And
just wonderful.
God bless her. Good for
her. When do we all get to go back to Dollywood?
I know, right? I think that's still open.
No, I don't think it's open.
It's closed. Right?
I've never been to Dollywood, but have you ever seen a concert?
No.
Can't say that I have.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's like any of these people who are true performers.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily have to like the music or whatever. They're just
I would go see Dolly Parton. It just never came up. I mean, if she was, I would happily go see her. She's got some stuff.
She's got some stuff.
Just a couple of tunes here and there.
Yeah. Just a couple of tunes here and there. And speaking of couple, she refers to her boobs as shock and awe, which is so great. So great.
She went on, you know what I like about her is exactly that. She has, it never feels like she's being laughed at. It feels like she's in on the joke, which I think
she's
is
always in
really smart on her part. I think that's incredibly smart on her part to take ownership of it from minute one, you know?
Yeah. And she's an icon in many worlds. She's an icon in the LGBTQ world.
Yeah, sure.
And I can't remember which award show it was, but somebody she was presenting with got a little political and she makes a boob joke about her own boob.
Yeah.
And afterwards she says, look, I don't do politics. And, you know, when push comes to shove and I need to, you know, whatever, I do a boob joke.
You're right.
The well is endless.
Yeah. She's
with Dolly. It is.
Yes.
Yes, it is. Okay. All right, Nevin, let's talk cookbooks.
Yes.
Oh, yes. We have to. Yes, you have to do this because I need a favor from you, Nevin.
Well, there's the Founding Farmers Cookbook, which is great at this time of year. Awesome.
Good.
Giving you all the recipes.
Okay.
What's your favorite?
I have a wife. Did you ask Nevin what his favorite is?
No, I'm asking you what's your favorite. What do you need?
I have a wife who may or may not be having a birthday very soon after Thanksgiving. And I want to cook her dinner and I can't make anything. I'm really bad at cooking. I'm terrible at it. And I would like to make her dinner. And I was thinking about it today. And
what does she like?
I mean, she likes everything. She said to me, you could make steak. And I was like, of course I could make a steak, but I don't want to make steak. I want to do something different, you know?
Well, it really depends on what she likes and what your comfort level is, which sounds like minimal. But does she like salmon? Like doing
sometimes?
Really beautiful.
Yes.
You know, you could do like a cedar plank style salmon, which is so easy. Like it's hard to mess it up.
Okay.
And then do some sort of, you know, winter vegetable on the side, or do something fancy like Dauphin potatoes or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, some nice wine. You know,
like wine I can do that. I'm good at. I can get that.
And then do a really nice cheese and charcuterie board to start, which you don't even need to put together yourself, but it looks really nice.
She loves cheese. She's from Wisconsin. So,
well, there you go. And then for dessert, you know, like, you know, step into the baking realm and do something. Or, you know, if you don't feel comfortable baking, I know
that's like a baker, like an apple, not an apple pie. What's the thing with the
tart tete?
Yeah, something like a tart. Yeah, something like that.
Tart tete, all you need is apples. You make a caramel sauce. You saute the apples in it, then you put that pre-made puff pastry, the really good Dufour that you get at Whole Foods on top, flip it over, and you're done. Honestly, a tarte tatin, again, it's one of those things that looks super, super impressive. And there's a couple of times when you can mess it up most when you flip it over. But it's a great dish. It's perfect at this time of year. Feels like the holidays, but it's not something you're necessarily going to eat at the holidays. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, don't stress yourself out too much. Like I said, if you preload the meal with a cheese and charcuterie board that somebody else put together, there's this great place in Maryland called Cheese MD, CHEEZMD on Instagram. She puts together these beautiful grazing boards and you go pick them up at her home in Bethesda.
Yeah.
Melissa Cohen, really awesome. I brought one home to the family and it's got all sorts of like little nibbles and bites on it. And that went over very well with my family.
Awesome.
I wasn't even trying to impress someone for a birthday.
Awesome. So. This
I can
good.
Do the charcuterie board, David, if you want. Because
there you go.
You know, pre-pandemic, you guys used to hang out in my dining room.
I know.
I had a pretty mean charcuterie board.
You did.
I bet you did.
I wanted to stay at your house, but you wouldn't let me. So
the room is always there, especially since we've kicked out the oldest son because he got tested positive for COVID.
He's
There's
got
more room.
Oh, guys. Yeah, he's got to go.
Knock on wood. Right? Knock on wood, as I told Nevin, day Knock 4, congestion, loss of taste and smell, but that's it so far. So
okay, good. But
fingers crossed.
Yeah,
fingers
hopefully, crossed. Hopefully all good. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, well, so Nevin, what makes a good cookbook? I love Founding Fathers. I'm doing several things that you marked for me last year. We're doing the cornbread stuffing.
Yeah.
We're doing the Ricky.
Yeah.
But we're adding the gin. You had like cute.
The Ricky.
Yeah.
But
I think the key to a cookbook is knowing your audience and writing to them,
right,
in the sense that, you know, it's always so bad when you pick up a cookbook from a chef and you really want to get a taste of their work in your home. And you see that the recipes are 3 pages long and require the kinds of equipment and the kinds of techniques and the kinds of ingredients that you just can't handle. And so, you know, I think that's the first key, is like knowing your audience and writing to them. I think the second key is writing recipes in a way that is digestible. You know, so many cookbooks, you pick them up and you're supposed to have all this inherent knowledge. And again, you know, so many of the readers of cookbooks have never been to culinary school. They've never cooked professionally. They've never been in a restaurant kitchen. So you need digestible recipes. And also you just need things that pop off the page, whether that's because of the way you've titled the recipe, the way you've written the recipe head, or the picture you've taken. And if the pictures and the words don't pop off the page, people are just going to flip by the recipe and it might be the most delicious thing in your repertoire or that you serve at your restaurant. But if you can't make the case with the picture or the words, then it's not worth it.
Right.
So that, I think those are the three keys to a really successful cookbook.
As you guys know, I think visually.
Yeah.
That's my excuse for being stupid. It's like, I think visually.
But
both the Founding Farmers cookbook and the Red Truck Bakery cookbook, which you did. And if I repeat myself, people, if you've not had the Red Truck Bakery granola, you've never experienced crack cocaine. So I'm just going to go out there and try it. The photographs are beautiful. And I've got to believe you had a big hand in that, because.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the publishers, you know, reserved the right to choose the photographer, and they ended up choosing the photographer for that book. And we were so glad with the choice that they made for us. It was, you know, he had worked with any number of national food publications and general interest publications, did a beautiful job. And, you know, you do have to sell not just the recipe, but the story. And I think that's what the Red Truck Bakery cookbook did such a good job of. It really told Brian's story, both in the words that we put down together on the page and the pictures that accompanied it. So you got a sense of place, you got a sense of person, and then you got a sense of the recipes. Can I tell you the cookbook that I'm obsessed with right now?
Please.
All right. So I'm obsessed with Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast by Ken Forkish. He's a baker who owns Ken's Artisan Bakery out in Portland, Oregon. And it is bread, focaccia, pizza dough making, designed specifically for the home baker. And what makes this cookbook great is that all the recipes are made in Dutch ovens, in a conventional oven. Each recipe comes with a schedule. So you know, okay, at 8 a.m. I have to do this on day one, and day two at 12 p.m. I'll be baking. So anytime you look at a recipe, you know what you're getting into and when you need to be present. Because bread baking is, you know, it's a long period of time, but there's so little active time in the course of making it. So, I mean, you know, it'll be like fold your bread 4 times. Each fold takes less than a minute, but you have to be around for 2 hours to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so
that's like, I'm sorry, going back to our earlier conversation about raising children, that's like breastfeeding babies. They tell you it's every 3 hours, but no, you got to be on call.
Gotta be ready.
I always felt so bad. My wife got so good at, what did she call it, or what is it called, dream feeding, when essentially like she would sleep with Zephyr next to her and he would just latch on in the middle of the night, and I'm not sure either of them were conscious for the entirety of the experience, but he would get fed and she would give it up and that would be the end of it.
So I dropped the kids
just so my kids were 18 years old. I was not conscious till 18 years old.
I just dropped the children when I had them at night.
Aww.
Hold them like that. Sorry about that. Walk it off. You'll be fine.
All right, Nevin, how has the pandemic changed or shaped, if it has, your Thanksgiving plans?
It's been a big shift. You know, we're not traveling. We're not seeing extended family. We're not even seeing any friends. It'll just be me, my wife, and my son gathered around a table in the living room. And kind of as a nod to the fact that I would want to do everything, but I can't do everything, we are buying a pre-brined turkey from Avoila in the palace.
Oh, yeah. I love Avoila.
Claudio and his team do an awesome job. So we'll bake it off and make, again, it'll be kind of like the people that pick up the loaves of bread that are just ready to bake. So we'll feel like we've done something. It comes with some sides, and then we'll make a whole bunch of desserts and side dishes that we would traditionally eat that nobody else in the world except our family makes. And so, right. You know, it's a little bit, it's definitely gonna be a little different. And then we'll end the day with Zoom calls with our respective families.
Yeah.
To bring everyone together.
What about you guys?
My wife bought a duck. She wants to try duck this year.
Duck, wow. Yeah.
She said, let's do something different for Thanksgiving. Because again, it's just going to be us.
Right. Yeah. Where'd
you get it?
You know, that's a good question. I don't remember where she said she got it, but she's very happy.
You know,
with
down
it.
On the mall? Did she like go to
no,
the
No, she didn't go to, she didn't get it off a food truck. She went to a store and bought a duck. I don't know.
Is it prepared or is she cooking it herself?
I think she's cooking it herself.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Lucky you, man.
You know, that's what I want to cook for her the following week, you know?
Yeah.
So, this is not something I'm a guy. I was like, should I go to Giant and get something? You know what I mean? That's what I was going to do for Thanksgiving dinner. I can get a rotisserie chicken. They sell them over there.
I do love a good rotisserie chicken.
Yeah. So, but she wants to try it and try something different. So I said, look, if you want to do it, you don't have to really. I mean, we can just get something, but she wants to do something, which is fine. And same thing, Zoom calls later on.
Zoom is going to be very busy on Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening. Yeah.
It's going to be a little bonkers.
Yeah, and I think they'll all fail. But our nuclear pod is really getting
smaller. Take that from us, please.
It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But a few days ago, I suggested to our nuclear pod, maybe do something different this year. And it's like, nope. I mean, we have a binder with the same recipes, the same sides, the same things
that
we've done since 2006. And the immediate visceral response was, no, we're doing that. We'll do less of it. So there will be a deep fat fried turkey, which is always just sheer entertainment and risk.
And
a turkey cooked in the oven.
Be careful.
So you get the smell, right? We do it outdoors.
Good. Oh, you do it yourself. Nice.
That's a fire. You don't want
that. Yeah, that's fire. Yeah. Peanut oil at 565 degrees. Nothing like it, right? We'll do that.
That's danger waiting to happen.
I know. It's great. Every year, two of our favorite things to do is to look up how many people were severely injured and or died from deep fat fried turkeys.
It's just bad. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the, I think it's called the Butterball 1-800.
Sure.
Say, I cooked my wallet in the turkey. Is that a problem? Or
is that bad?
Yeah, is that bad? Is that wrong? Okay, here's my lightning round on turkey.
Okay.
For both of you. Do you call it stuffing or dressing?
Stuffing.
Stuffing, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I agree. I don't know where this whole dressing thing came from.
I think that's more of a Southern.
It's like a plantation thing, isn't it, Nevin?
Probably.
That doesn't work for me. So.
Yeah, right. Neither.
Do you cook your stuffing in the bird or on the stove?
You should never cook it in the bird because it throws off the cook time and can lead to parts of the turkey not being fully cooked. So you can get salmonella. It's an awful idea to cook it inside.
Yeah. But Nevin, as the daughter of a doctor, how many decades did we do that?
Oh, I used to love it because it gets super moist from the, the juices and the fats of the turkey. And I used to love it. And then you get a little bit older and you're like, this is awful from a food safety perspective. And it takes longer to cook your turkey if there's stuffing inside it. So it's not good.
All right. Sweet potatoes or mashed potatoes?
Crime to say both?
Yeah, I would pick sweet potatoes if I had to, but I'll take them both.
We do both. Canned or fresh cranberry sauce?
I always make it and it always fails. So we always have a can too.
Yeah, I don't think, we haven't had cranberry sauce for years because for the last, literally the last 25 years, we've taken my father out to dinner because that's what he wants to do. This will be the first year we're not doing that in a very long time. But always, in a can, sliced. Yeah.
Ocean spray.
The last several years we do fresh, but I got to tell you, I love the fact that it came out of a can.
Yep.
And it would show up on somebody's plate with the line still, like the cylindrical shape of the can.
Yeah. I love that too. Of course.
Okay. Here's the most important question. This time last year, Michael was on the show, Michael Kornheiser.
Oh yes. I remember this well.
He was desperately seeking Nevin's advice because he had appropriately and thoughtfully and preemptively bought a turkey to cook with his
I remember this. Yes.
Yeah. And he said, I vaguely remember he said something about keeping the turkey on the back porch, which kind of concerned me right off the bat.
Yeah.
And Nevin was describing to you a certain smell that was coming off the turkey.
He said it smelled a little off.
a little off. Yeah. Do you guys know what happened?
Well, I told him that he should just go ahead and cook it because I have a pretty high bar when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah. He didn't trust you. Michael is not a trustworthy guy.
No, he's not. Clearly not.
Just nuke it. It should be okay, right?
He went out and bought another turkey, and the family lived to, you know, celebrate another Thanksgiving. So that was good.
Wow.
I cannot tell you, as we were leading up this show, and David, with all due respect to you and me and Claude and Evan, people are really looking forward to Jeannie McManus, but I kept getting these emails from people. Whatever happened to Michael's turkey, the smelly turkey?
The smelly turkey. Wow. Well, I'm glad that they all lived to eat another day.
And exactly.
I think that they probably would have lived to eat another day regardless, but whatever makes you feel happy and safe, like God, for, you know, there's enough anxiety and angst and stress around Thanksgiving. You don't need to add another level.
Okay. So I was reminded of this earlier today, and this goes to our earlier conversation about parenting and turkeys. So growing up, when I was little, I didn't appreciate what was going on. But again, my dad was a doctor. My mom raised five girls, largely on her own.
Right.
And Thanksgiving and Christmas would come along. And every Thanksgiving and Christmas, my mom would make all the stuff and the turkey. And my dad didn't like turkey. So there was always, she would also make a roast beef for him.
Wow.
And he was a doctor, so it had to be massively overcooked. But she would find and treat and prepare and cook the roast beef in addition to every Thanksgiving, every Christmas.
Wow.
So I start to get a little bit older, like, you know, middle school, high school. I'm like, wow, this is a lot of effing work. I'm not helping, but this is a lot of work. And then, you know, maybe the first couple of years in college, I would still come home for Thanksgiving, Christmas. And my mom would be like, you know, working herself to the bone.
To the bone, yeah.
And making the freaking turkey and making the roast beef. And I was like, you've got to stop this. And she goes, no, your dad likes it so much or whatever. And he'd like bop in and clueless or whatever. So God bless her. My mom passes away and my dad started spending all the holidays with us, which is great.
Yeah.
So it's the first holiday he's dead. It's the first Thanksgiving he's down here. And we're puttering around and doing 9 million things. And we've got our recipes and stuff, whatever. And he's pretending to be helpful in the kitchen, which meant he was drinking his martinis.
Right.
And his scotch. And he's kind of looking around and he sees all the food being prepared. He's trying to help. And at some point he says to me, where's the roast beef? And I said, there is a new sheriff in town.
Whoa. How'd that go over?
And he just kind of looked at me with kind of like shocked amazement. And I said, and if you don't like the turkey, there are a lot of sides and there's always more scotch.
Right.
And from that day forward, and he spent many, many Thanksgivings and Christmas and other holidays with
him.
It was turkey. And shockingly, he choked it down.
Stunningly, he adapted.
Your mom, man. She was obviously.
That is awesome to her.
She was remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. And she did it just because she loved him and she loved doing it for him. And for her, it was no effort.
It was no big deal, right?
No big deal.
For me, it was an effing big deal.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And when my dad first started spending Thanksgiving and Christmas with us, our kids were little and I was on the edge at all times. Like massively sleep deprived. Had the shakes. Anything could set me off. And if he had complained about the turkey, it would have been another thing. Yeah. Okay. So we got a little bit of housekeeping and then our deserted island segment, which I fully appreciate. It's very sappy. We have some great authors coming up over the next several weeks. David, Andrew Cotter.
Good.
And the Labradors, all of them able, will be joining us.
It's outstanding.
Nevin, do you know about Andrew Cotter and Olive and Mabel?
No, Olive and Mabel, no.
Well, you know, years from now, people are going to look back and say, who did well because of the pandemic? And it's this relatively obscure BBC sports guy named Andrew Cotter, who was bored in the first couple of months of the pandemic because he had no sports to cover. So he started doing the play-by-plays of his Labradors, all of them interacting.
Got it. Yes, I've heard about this. Yeah.
All you need to know is that all of them Mabel have more followers than David Aldridge on Twitter.
As well they should.
Wow.
Spectacular. And of course, a month into the pandemic and Olive and Mabel's success, they get a book deal. So they have a book.
Oh man, I'm really, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's their agent? I got to tell you.
It's called All of Mabel and Me, Life and Adventures with Two Very Good Dogs. And again, I don't think Andrew Cotter really knew what he was doing when he accepted to be on Chatter and Books, but they'll be coming up.
Yeah, no, that'll be fun.
Yeah, but next week we have what may be a first and last for Chatter and Books, and that is we're going to do a live Zoom event.
Ooh. At
the Penguin Bookshop, which is in my hometown outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Huh.
We, of course, will spend the first 10 minutes ragging on David about the lack of coverage of Steelers.
Stop it.
Just saying. Just saying. And then we're going to talk to two really incredible authors, both from Pittsburgh. Yona Harvey, who has, shockingly, this show has brought me around on poetry, which I thought would never happen.
Wow.
But she's got a collection called You Don't Have to Go to Mars for Love, which is a really incredible collection of poetry. Yona is this. I cannot wait to talk to her. She is among the first Black women to ever write for Marvel Comics. Nevin, are you into comics? Are you into all that whole...
I was as a kid, and now I'm reintroducing all my favorites to my son, which has been a ton of fun. But I don't keep up with contemporaneous comics.
So she, Yona is one of the first Black women to write for Marvel Comics, and she was the first Black woman to write for the Marvel character Storm, who's one of the big...
Oh, cool. Yeah, sure.
But she has this incredible poetry. I can't believe I like it. And Disha Filia, who's got The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, which was recently...
Oh, yeah.
Shortlisted for the National Book Award. Again, Chatter on Books reflected glory. She accepted our invitation to appear on the show. Then she gets shortlisted for the National Book Award. I'm just saying.
Coincidence?
Probably. Coincidence, I'm just saying. I don't think so. But we're putting out the information out. It's a live Zoom event on Monday evening, David. Yes. We can still drink, but it's live. We may never do it again. But that's next week, which will be great. In the meantime, everybody, download us, review us. We love that. Okay, Deserted Island, it's a little sappy, but I am feeling a little sappy.
Aww, this time why of year. Are you sappy?
No, I'm sappy because I thought about this group last year.
Yeah.
And I thought about, we sat, you know, in the dining room, and we had an amazing charcuterie together.
It was fantastic.
And I love being with all of you. And I love my family.
Aww.
And I have spent incredible time with my family, and at ages and stages I never thought I would. But I miss all of that. So I get a little sappy about this. So I wanted to do for Deserted Island, is there a book for which you've been thankful this year?
Hmm.
And I'll do mine first, and then we'll do David, and then we'll do Nevin. And mine is one we haven't talked about in this show, but I should. And it's by Connie Schultz, who won the Pulitzer a couple years ago for Commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing woman. And she wrote a book called The Daughters of Erie Town. And I always say this, but I keep thinking lots of different people write books that are trying to be hillbilly elegy.
Yeah.
But she wrote this book, The Daughters of Erie Town, which is about several generations of women in a town in Ohio, which we would, you know, being the entitled people that we are, called flyover country.
Mm-hmm.
And it is gripping and riveting and just a remarkable book. And I really, really loved it. And I hope we get her on the show sometime to talk about it. But I read it. And I listened to it in my car, and I've gone back to it a couple of times. And it's just made me, it goes to what we've said throughout the show. During the pandemic, what's important? It is about family.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we all have the same challenges. We have the same problems. We have the same opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, Connie Schultz's words, money makes a big difference in all of it. But it really reminded me about what's important. So I'm very thankful for that book. So David?
Now they're going to make me all sappy. I don't want to be sappy. Anyway, honestly, I thought about it. I wanted to do it right. I wanted to come up with something and a good reason. And I haven't read as many books as I'd like this year, but I will go back to a book we talked a lot about in the spring because it was so appropriate, was Station 11.
Totally.
And I'll tell you why.
Totally.
I'll tell you why. Not because of its subject matter, because it was very, you know, concurrent.
Prescient by Michael.
Yeah, very concurrent.
Yeah.
The reason why I enjoyed the book so much is because for a couple of hours, I could think about something else. I could I could get lost in this story that was very interesting and sad, but very compelling reading and writing. And, you know, this has been a rough year. It's been really rough. And so to have even a slight diversion for a couple of hours meant a lot to me. So I would absolutely thank Emily in person if I ever see her for writing the book, because it was really well done, and it made, and it was a good book. It was a good read. I enjoyed reading it. I enjoy reading so little these days. I actually enjoyed reading that.
And thanks to Michael Kornheiser, who thought about that book way before the pandemic hit. For that exact reason, David, he talked about how it just allows you to lose yourself and go to a different place.
Right.
Awesome. Nevin, do you have a book for which you're thankful this year?
I do. It's Closer to the Ground by Dylan Tommen.
And,
he's a fisherman, forager, gardener who lives on Bainbridge Island across the Sound from Seattle. And it follows a full year, like a full life cycle in Mother Nature, of him and his family going out, you know, foraging, getting firewood from down trees, gardening, fishing for salmon, like basically a modern family kind of living with ancient ways, kind of wended into their life. And, you know, with my son and I, we went out morel hunting for the first time together this year. You know, the garden was really an emphasis during the summer.
Sure.
You know, and it was just, I was looking for somebody who'd kind of done what we ended up doing this year.
Yeah.
And he was, his writing is just gorgeous, you know, very poetic and just really beautiful, rich descriptions. And, you know, kind of like you, David, it was like very transportive, you know, it just took me out of, it reminded me of the things that I could be doing now, but it also kind of took me out of what was happening now. And it was just a really nice, beautiful read. And, you know, I hope he writes another book soon, because that was a nice little bit of escapism that I really desperately needed. So
nice.
Highly recommended.
Nice. I love that. I love that. I love being sappy.
Yeah. Come on.
Love it. All right, everybody. Nevin, thank you so much. Stay healthy. David. Love you, my friend.
Love you back.
Thank you for making everything happen as usual. Don't work too hard tonight. Get that pre-book paid.
Yeah, exactly. You get extra COVID pay. Yes, sir.
Everybody out there, wash your hands, wear a mask, have a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you. We'll see you in a week. Thanks, guys.